This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of September 18th, 2009. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show. From the Idea Center at WCPN, this is Marketplace Money. We're in Cleveland this week, where the recession washed over the banks of the Cuyahoga early and with no mercy. Foreclosure rates are among the highest in the nation. The auto industry's troubles brought local manufacturing to its knees. The most recent report from the Cleveland Federal Reserve showed what it called a slight improvement, though things are still, in their words, sluggish. How long will it take to get things rocking and rolling again? I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
Cleveland is home to one of the nation's preeminent medical facilities, and recently it's become a common reference in the debate over healthcare reform. The Cleveland Clinic is known nationwide for providing high-quality healthcare at a lower cost than many of its peers. This week, executives from the clinic and several other medical groups were in Washington to talk about reform. And their visit came at the same time that Montana Democrat Max Baucus unveiled his overhaul proposal as head of the Senate Finance Committee. Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon tells us this latest plan could bring some changes to existing employee benefits.
The proposal would put a limit on tax-free savings that workers are allowed to tap for out-of-pocket medical expenses. Those flexible spending accounts, or FSAs, would be capped for the first time at $2,000 a year. At WageWorks, an employee benefits administrator, Jody Dietl says the change would hit millions of FSA users with hundreds of dollars a year in new taxes. And while FSAs can currently be used to pay for any over-the-counter medicines, she says proposed new limits on those purchases would put an unnecessary burden on the whole system.
It really is going to drive up healthcare costs in our view because it will require you to go see the doctor to write you a prescription to get those over-the-counter medicines paid for by your account-based plans.
The money that workers put into their FSAs would also be counted toward a new federal cap on employer-provided medical benefits. And if the total value of those benefits exceeded the limits, the amount over the cap would be hit with a stiff new tax. At the benefits consulting firm The Siegel Company, Kathy Bakich says that 35% tax could catch many employers and employees off guard.
Lots of other things come under that cap, too. It's not just your health coverage. It's your dental, your vision, your hearing aids, your drugs, any health reimbursement account contributions. Everything is in there.
Supporters of the tax say it's aimed at so-called gold-plated health plans lavished on the highly paid. But at Health Policy and Strategy Associates, consultant Robert Leshefsky cautions they would probably end up wiggling out of it.
Politicians say, well, we're going to tax partners of Goldman Sachs. But I think, in fact, what would happen there is Goldman Sachs would probably cash these people out and let them go buy individual coverage, not subject to the 35% tax, no matter how expensive it is. So there's probably a way for the Wall Street types to get around it.
Leshefsky says it's actually benefit packages worth far less than the coverage enjoyed by those fat cats that would most likely fall victim to the higher taxes, including plans negotiated under union contracts for police, firemen, and teachers. By week's end, there were already reports that Senator Baucus would be willing to limit the scope of that new tax. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace Money.
Cleveland was one of the first major cities to be hit by the foreclosure crisis. The local economy also relies heavily on the auto industry, which, as we know, is still up on that hydraulic lift. And that means a lot of people here are out of work. And when workers lose their jobs, they naturally cut a lot of expenses. Reporter Dan Bobkoff of WCPN tells us that's having big ripple effects throughout the entire local economy.
John Kreisel's 10-year-old Pontiac could use some work.
It's got 132,000 miles on it. It just needs general maintenance a lot at a time.
But car repairs and a lot of other expenses will have to wait since he lost his job.
So we're driving by, I see a big Dirt Devil sign. This is where you used to work, right?
Yes, I personally had mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, technicians that reported to me.
Kreisel is 48. He had been heading a team developing a robotic vacuum to compete with the likes of the Roomba. But the company pulled the plug in January, leaving Kreisel and about 130 others there out of jobs.
I'd say we were leading a comfortable life. Not extravagant, but comfortable.
John Kreisel's car may need work, but his home is spacious and tidy, sitting in a development in Solon, one of Cleveland's wealthier suburbs. There's an in-ground pool in the backyard. A comfortable life means he had a pile of bills from the many businesses that get a piece of his income. So when Kreisel was cut in January, a lot of those companies got cut too.
We go to no movies. We got rid of Netflix, Blockbuster, everything. We don't do any of that.
But that's just the start. Kreisel cut expenses down to the essentials. No dinners out, fewer haircuts, definitely no lawn service. And the house cleaners? He pushes his own vacuum now. All told, Kreisel estimates he's cut about $1,000 from his monthly budget. That's $1,000 out of the local economy. Places like Blue Canyon, one of his favorite restaurants.
People just stopped going out. People were really scared. They didn't know what tomorrow was going to bring.
Chef Brant Evans is a co-owner at Blue Canyon, and he's talking there about the lowest point of the recession, right around the time Kreisel lost his job. Since then, the restaurant slashed the prices on nearly all entrees, and Evans had to get creative to keep diners spending.
I started actually offering smaller bite-sized desserts. Instead of an $8 dessert, I cut my desserts down in fours.
Kreisel's pool service is working to keep its customers, too. They lost John Kreisel this year. He got the pool ready for the summer himself, saving upwards of $1,000 in maintenance for the season. That's money not going to Kathy Saka and her husband. They run the pool servicing company, and while business is mostly holding up, she's nervous about revenues this year. So now she's cutting back, hurting other local businesses, like her favorite shoe shops.
Yes, no shoes. So now we're just cutting back on groceries. You know, we don't eat as well as we used to, you know, and I'm not getting my nails done anymore.
Now, you might think all companies will hurt when their customers suffer. But the thing with these ripple effects is that there can also be unexpected benefits, as Suka's business found.
So I think a lot of our customers may have cut back to keep the pools open, so instead of them going on vacations, at least they had the pool to jump in the backyard.
John Kreisel and his family had to skip their vacation, too.
We used to take vacation pretty much every year. We used to stay at Wild Dunes, which is up on the East Islands and outside of Charleston.
So I called up that South Carolina resort to see how it's faring.
We do feel people like John's absence on the resort.
Andressa Chapman is in charge of marketing at Wild Dunes. She says the typical guests who did come back are staying fewer days or downgrading their accommodations. But Chapman says Wild Dunes is also seeing a surprise, an influx of wealthier customers this year.
We're getting in a guest who potentially would have traveled abroad for vacation, but instead have chosen to stay closer to home and save a little bit more on their vacations.
That doesn't surprise Justin Sidner. He's a behavioral economist at Case Western Reserve University.
Businesses normally lie somewhere in a spectrum of sort of high end to low end. And what we expect in a recession is that most of that middle zone, it's hard to say what's going to happen to them because there's substitution. The people who used to eat caviar are trading down a little bit, and the people who used to stay at the nicest possible hotel room are likely to, you know, come down a bit.
But these companies shouldn't expect to see John Kreisel's money again soon. Even if he does land a new job, he's not ready to spend like he did before the layoff.
I'd probably say about a year before I would do that. I need to reestablish financially.
And that's why it could be a long time before the economy looks like it did before the crash. In Cleveland, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing and online surveys. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Wall Street marked the one-year anniversary this week of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, the one that started it all. President Barack Obama used the occasion to call, again, for regulatory reform. Our economics editor Chris Farrell is all for it, but he wonders how much the street can really change without major follow-through from Washington.
I happened to be in New York the same week as President Obama. And while walking around the canyons of Wall Street, I ended up at the corner of Wall and Broad. It's a remarkable physical symbol of both American capitalism and American democracy. On one side, you had the New York Stock Exchange. Across the street, the Federal Building, where George Washington took the oath of office as the first president of the United States. When I asked a longtime friend, who's covered the economy for years, what he thought about Obama's idea that Wall Street needed the change, he laughed. "Look, Wall Street is as busy as ever making money," he said. "That's what Wall Street does." He's right. Sure, business has been down over the past year. The regulators have tightened their grip. But Wall Street is on the same rebound as the economy. It's been several years since I walked in Lower Manhattan. It struck me that some investment banks I used to follow are gone, but other banks have moved in. There are condominiums now, even a BMW dealership. I love the energy. But here's the thing. Wall Street is unique in American society. It truly thrives on change and turmoil. At least that's according to Richard Silla, an economic historian at New York University. "They're trying to predict where the world is going," he told me recently. "And the people who can get in on the ground floor will make a fortune." Alec Young, an equity strategist at S&P, echoed Silla, arguing that despite all the trauma of the past year, the Wall Street fundamentals haven't changed. It's a place where a lot of driven people get together looking to innovate and to see the next money-making opportunity. "That's the core of Wall Street," he says. "It's why I love it." Me too. But the relentless drive for money and profit is also why Washington can't stumble with major regulatory reform. We can't have another round of Wall Street bailouts when the next boom goes bust, and Wall Street needs to know that. Otherwise, traders will decide with time that the path to riches is to make as many heads I win and tails the taxpayer loses bets as possible. It's in the nature of the beast.
Chris Farrell with some thoughts on Wall Street's ability to change its stripes. Here in Cleveland, there are houses selling for less than $10,000. Want one? Just go online, but don't count on getting the whole story from the sellers.
If you think of these properties almost as defective products, for the lenders to simply put them back out in the marketplace is only causing more damage.
It's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We're coming to you this week from Cleveland. The foreclosure crisis here in Cuyahoga County is staggering. Right now, according to RealtyTrack, nearly 15,000 homes are in some stage of it throughout the county. 10,000 of those are in Cleveland proper. Ohio was hit earlier than many of the places we hear about, including Florida and Vegas. Part of that is because of unemployment in the manufacturing sector. But a recent study comparing this state to neighboring Pennsylvania suggests there were other factors at play as well. Marketplace's Rico Galliano has that story.
One ironically sunny afternoon, I take a sobering ride with Mike Polensic. He's councilman for Cleveland's 11th Ward.
This corner, we have taken down 3 abandoned houses here.
In how much time?
In the last year. Take a left right here.
Polensic showing me an area he represents called Collinwood. He points out home after home, boarded up or demolished. Almost all of them, he says, the result of foreclosures due to predatory lending. Lenders peddling risky mortgages to people who clearly couldn't afford them. The fallout is devastating.
Now here's this corner house right here, stop right here, is my mother-in-law. Both of these houses next to her are abandoned. The house across the street, that was abandoned, we tore it down. The house behind her is abandoned. Here she is, 90-year-old. The real estate agent told us if we could get $25,000 for her house, we'd be lucky.
This level of foreclosure isn't unusual in parts of Cleveland these days, but it is unusual just a 2-hour drive away in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. That caught the attention of the Federal Reserve's regional office in Cleveland. In a recent report, it compared North Collinwood to a neighborhood in the Pittsburgh area called Braddock. Fed researcher Lisa Nelson explains why.
statistically, they have similar characteristics. Same percentages of subprime lending, similar educational attainment levels, similar credit scores, similar poverty rates. Everything else about them seemed very similar.
Except, the report found, their foreclosure rates. North Collinwood's rate in 2007, almost 21%. Braddock's, 5%. Both places should have been equally hit by foreclosures, but the Ohio community got hit harder.
And the question is why?
The Fed figures since local characteristics are the same, there must have been some difference between these states that accounts for the disparity. What could that be? That's what the Fed's researching now. But some decision makers are already posing their own hypotheses. Jim Rokakis is Ohio's treasurer.
I think it's really a matter of state regulation. Pennsylvania had it, and as a result, they suffered this foreclosure crisis a lot less than we did.
He says Pennsylvania covered mortgages under its consumer protection law. Up until 2007, Ohio was one of only two states that didn't. And he says, unlike Ohio, Pennsylvania actually enforced predatory lending regulations on the books.
We became the Wild West of lending. There was no regulatory sheriff in town. And in the old days when there was no sheriff in town, people would rob the banks. Here was a little different. The banks were robbing the people.
Fed advisor Joseph Ott says the jury's still out on the ultimate cause of the two states' foreclosure split. But he says as the crisis deepened, Pennsylvania's regulatory sheriff, the Department of Banking, did get especially active. It doubled its staff, created a new division specifically to investigate lenders, and started fining them.
From about 2003 to 2006, the Pennsylvania Department of Banking increased their annual rate of fines from about $20,000 to about $1 million annually.
Over the same 3 years, Ohio handed out only about $500,000 total. Ohio enforcers eventually got more aggressive, but not until later in the crisis. And Pennsylvania may have benefited from doing something else early, too, namely going through its own foreclosure crisis decades ago. That's the exhaust from one of Pittsburgh's last remaining steel mills. There used to be dozens of them, but when they folded in the early 1980s, the job loss was staggering. Randy Lowe is with Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment, a group that encourages local development.
Block on blocks of houses were being foreclosed. Whole neighborhoods were being gutted. And the state came up with this program to try to help resolve that, and it's been in place ever since.
Simply put, that program, known by the acronym HMAP, provides temporary loans to some homeowners in danger of foreclosure. No other state has a program like it. And the Fed's investigating whether these loans helped Pennsylvania avoid Ohio's foreclosure mess. If so, according to Lowe's co-worker Bethany Davidson, Pennsylvania lawmakers should take heed.
We are the last state in the country to pass a budget, which means we haven't passed a budget. The proposals on the table to bring them back to a balanced budget all have significant cuts to HMAP.
Which brings up a larger question. Whatever Fed researchers eventually conclude, whatever Pennsylvania did which softened the subprime blow, the state's actions probably cost money. At a time when state and federal dollars are hard to come by, who's going to pay? Meanwhile, Councilman Mike Polensic says for neighborhoods like North Collinwood, any regulation will arrive too late.
It's like the Titanic. It's sinking. You know it's sinking. And the problem is the damage is done.
He says the city of Cleveland will spend $16 million this year tearing down abandoned homes. In Cleveland, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
We are not done with our Cleveland foreclosure tours just yet. When I heard that some of the city's foreclosed properties are for sale on eBay, well, I had to see them for myself. Apparently, so-called investors from around the country are buying these homes sight unseen, some of them for mere hundreds of dollars. So I decided to talk with Frank Ford. He works for a Cleveland nonprofit called Neighborhood Progress, and he's been watching as these buyers start to realize what they've gotten themselves into. We met at what was supposed to be one of those bought-on-the-internet homes in Cleveland's Fairfax neighborhood. Frank Ford, welcome to the program. Thanks for meeting me out here.
Thank you.
Describe for me what we're looking at, which is basically an empty lot with hay on it.
Right, and a bulldozer sitting here. This is a house, was a house, that looked very nice from the outside. And if you were internet shopping, you saw a photograph, you'd say, geez, this looks good for $4,900. In fact, it's still listed as of last night on Yahoo Real Estate for $4,900, even though it's already torn down.
Yeah, there is no house here.
Right, there's no house. There's just a pile of dirt with some straw on it. You know, investing in real estate is on the internet is very different from buying, say, a vintage guitar or a set of wheels for your truck or some personal property. Because there, if you spend, say, $3,000, you're out only your $3,000. Here, if you spend $3,000 or, say, $4,900 on this house and then it gets torn down by the city, you're going to get a bill from the city for $10,000 for the demolition.
And presumably down the line, unless you sell it, you're still going to be paying property taxes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, actually, not only are you paying property taxes, but the city of Cleveland will then come by, and if you don't mow the lawn, they will mow it for you, and they're not cheap.
Let's take this back a step and explain what we're talking about. When you mention buying homes on the internet, I think that would be a new concept for most people.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether it's happening in every city, but in a lot of the cities that have been hardest hit by the foreclosure problem, you know, the volume is so great that it's just caused real estate values to plummet. And so the banks that have taken these properties back at foreclosure find themselves sitting on an inventory of basically stuff they can't move. They're dropping prices dramatically. So it is not uncommon to find houses for $10,000, $5,000, even $1,000. And some of them are just being put on the internet, on eBay, on various real estate internet sites. If it's a single inexperienced investor who's watching the late night infomercials about how to buy real estate, those shows don't tell you about the pitfalls of buying real estate, that you can't rely upon the photographs. Because this property, actually, from the outside, honestly, when I first saw it, I thought, this is very nice. Inside, it was a disaster.
And it's still up on the internet.
It was on yahoorealestate.com last night, I checked, even though I knew it was down. For $4,900.
Bargain at half the price, I
right,
suppose?
Yeah.
Well, let's go ahead and look at another property that you
mentioned.
Yeah,
we'll go to the one, it's a few blocks away where an investor from California bought it.
All right, so here we are a few blocks away, and a nice-looking house here. Tell me what we're looking at.
Well, we're looking at a wood frame house, a little smaller than the other one we looked at. I mean, it's in reasonably decent shape. They've put, I don't know the exact figures, but I'm guessing that it's in the $10,000, $15,000, some cosmetic improvements.
Do you know, was this property bought sight unseen?
That's what I was told, that this investor from California bought it as an internet sale. I think in this case, though, here the failure is the failure to appreciate the market changes in Cleveland. So as the market has declined, the investor's original plan to get $70,000 for this was just way overinflated beyond what the reality is of the current market.
Who is buying these homes on the internet?
Buyers who buy in bulk, 10, 20, 30 properties at a time, and some of them just view themselves as wholesalers. And if they make even $100 on each sale, they're happy because they're buying 20. Maybe they're spending $1,000.
What is this kind of thing doing to the housing market itself?
Well, unfortunately, it's perpetuating a problem and aggravating it and making it worse. If you think of these properties almost as defective products, for the lenders to simply put them back out in the marketplace is only causing more damage. What we would prefer to see is that the lenders take responsibility for these properties before they essentially dump them in our marketplace.
Is there confidence in this city that the real estate market will return?
Actually, the good sign is that in the last year, foreclosure filings in the city of Cleveland have dropped. They are increasing in the suburbs, but the good news is that for the city of Cleveland and its future for rebuilding is that we're seeing fewer foreclosures, and we are going to see an end to this. And as we do, it means the rebuilding and the cleaning up is going to really become more important.
Frank Ford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Frank Ford giving me a tour of foreclosed homes in Cleveland that were or are for sale on the internet. He's the Senior Vice President for Research and Development at the Cleveland nonprofit Neighborhood Progress. And for more, you can check out our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It is time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions about money. And since we are here in Cleveland, Ohio, we thought we'd get a local expert to chime in. Cheryl Harris is a consumer columnist for the Cleveland Plain Dealer newspaper. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi.
I'm so glad that you could join us while we're here in Cleveland.
I'm glad you asked me.
Well, let's get right to helping out some of our listeners. First, we have John in Washington, D.C. Hi, John.
Hi there.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, unfortunately, I am recently unemployed. I have some savings, and I'm not eligible for unemployment benefits.
Why is that?
Actually, I just spoke with the employment office person today who tells me that unemployment in D.C. is based on your most recent employer who you had for at least 30 days. And so when I lost my job, I immediately got a job waiting tables, but I was making very poor money there because it was summer in Washington. No one's in town. I was there for about 2 months, and so that became my most recent employer. And because I voluntarily quit, I am not eligible for unemployment, even though I have plenty of wages from my previous employer.
Wow. So at this point, you don't have an income.
Right.
So you're living on your savings account. You're drawing down from your savings account every month to pay your living expenses. Is that right?
Yes. I have enough cash that I can live on my cash just for probably 4 or 5 months. I also have a few credit cards that I have no balance at all on. I've always paid the full credit card bill.
So what's your question?
Which concerns me more? Is it carrying a balance on my credit card or having no money in my bank account?
Cheryl, that is a really tough question. Bottom line is he either carries a balance or he potentially literally runs out of money in his bank account.
Okay, but let's say you carry the balance. Okay, let's just play devil's advocate here. You carry the balance, you're paying it down, and all of a sudden you still come to the end of the bank account. Well, now you're at the end of your bank account and you're in debt. I mean, I think that's a worse position to be in. And right now, credit card interest rates are really unstable. I mean, if you look in your statement, it will tell you they can change the rules at whim. They can still do that until February. I wouldn't want my fate in their hands. You want to hope for the best, but you don't have income, so I would plan for the worst. I'm curious, are you in D.C.? Do you live alone? Are you there for job or family? I mean,
I have one roommate who is also unemployed.
Right. And, you know, I think it might be helpful for you to think in terms of short range and long range. You know, what's going to happen long range if you can't get employed by the time that you set a deadline? And, you know, this resource may be really, really helpful for you. It's called Managing in Tough Times. It is a website that was put up by the Cooperative Extension. And we always think of the extension as, you know, help for farmers. But
right.
Really, there is this army of home economists who are attached to the extension. Their job is to teach people all about money management. And on this particular website, it's MITTNet, that stands for Managing in Tough Times Net, .extension.org. There are clever ways that maybe you can barter your time or talents in exchange for things that you need to sort of protect your paycheck in the meantime.
What do you think, John?
I will definitely check it out.
Thanks so much for the call, John, and good luck.
Sure. Thanks for your help.
And next we have Maria in Mankato, Minnesota. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Tess. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Maria.
I have a question about credit cards. I've always been pretty good about paying off my credit cards from month to month. But once in a while, maybe once every couple of years, I forget to make a payment and I get stuck with a late fee. It used to be that I could call the bank and get them to remove these late fees based on my history of paying off my balances. But just recently, I had one of these mess-ups and called the bank, and they are not being so generous anymore. And so my question is, are they going to make a bad mark on my credit rating?
Cheryl, I don't think that generous is a term that we use for the banks these days,
you know,
is it?
This is part of the bank's ongoing campaign. You know, they just had like new rules issued by the Fed. You know, the Congress steps in and they issue extra rules. And now this is the bank's campaign to like tick off every remaining consumer who really didn't care about the debate in the first place. So, yeah. You know, there are all kinds of late, Maria. There's bank late. Bank late is your bill was due the 24th at 2 o'clock, and we didn't process your check until 2:05. You're 5 minutes late, and we're going to charge you a late fee.
Ouch.
And that is something that banks won't be able to do after February. After February, everybody is going to have to say you have until 5 o'clock to pay. And then, luckily for all of us, I think, there's credit report late. And that is a payment has to be 30 days late before it can be reported to your credit report. So when you forgot your bill, like, how late do you think you were?
I was a day late. I still paid the $15 penalty, but that wasn't as big a deal to me as thinking about the long-term consequences.
So, Maria, it sounds like you're okay, but maybe make a habit of every single month being on time.
I will.
Definitely.
All right, Maria, thank you so much for the call. I hope that helped out.
It did. Thanks so much, Tess. Thanks, Cheryl.
Sure thing.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you've got a question, we will take it on, and we will not send you a bill, will we, Cheryl?
Not me.
You can give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can send us an email. You'll find the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more questions with Cheryl Harris from the Cleveland Plain Dealer later in the show. Thinking about buying your first home? Only a couple more months to cash in on that $8,000 tax credit. But it should not be the deciding factor in whether or not you jump into the real estate market.
When you think about it, it's really only enough to cover maybe the closing costs and maybe a chunk of your down payment, a small chunk of that down payment.
That story and a money tour of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Who wants to buy a house? Not on eBay, but, you know, the old-fashioned way. This year, first-time potential homeowners have an extra incentive, the $8,000 tax credit. That financial carrot is set to expire at the end of November, so does that mean it's time to jump in? Personal finance author Beth Koblenner says, maybe, but only if you have all of your financial ducks in a row. Beth, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
It does seem that the housing market is starting to pick up a little bit, and at least in our email inbox, I'm guessing yours as well, a younger generation is now thinking, maybe it's time to take advantage of this. Are you seeing that as well?
Absolutely. You know, I think this is the generation that missed out on a lot. You know, they're like, where's our gravy train? We missed out on the stock market boom. We missed out on the tech market boom. Our 401ks are pathetic.
But wait a minute. Since when are 20-somethings supposed to be on the gravy train?
They're never supposed to be on the gravy train, but they feel like there was always a feeling you were kind of, if you did the right thing, you can ride it and reach that gravy train. If there's, what's, I don't know what the analogy is, a big bowl of gravy at the end of the gravy train. But I think that, you know, there was a sense of, oh, if you eventually save enough for a home, you can get a home mortgage and that's a great investment. Or, oh, if I could only put enough money in my 401k, that's a great investment. There are all these sort of senses, if you did the right thing, you'll be okay. And now I think that's been pulled out from under them.
What about getting into the housing market at this point? There is this first-time home buyer tax credit, $8,000. But how much should that factor into whether you buy or not?
You know, it's just one factor because it sounds like a lot, $8,000, and that's great, and it's definitely a good deal. And what the rules say is that basically you get 10% of the purchase price put back to you up to an $80,000 home. So the most it could be is $8,000. Sounds really good, but when you think about it, it's really only enough to cover maybe the closing costs and maybe a chunk of your down payment, a small chunk of that down payment.
So it's almost like a bonus.
That's right. Now, remember, though, there is an income cutoff. It phases out for single people who earn over $95,000 and for married couples who earn over $170,000.
The fact that the housing market is on sale in most parts of the country, that seems like it's also prompting a lot of people to think, if I don't get in now, then it's going to get expensive again. So let's just go ahead and do it. What do you need to keep in mind?
The number one thing is you want to buy a home if you're going to live in it. It sounds obvious, but we still have that mentality of thinking of a home as an investment. Interest rates are very low, but when you look at closing costs of a home and broker's fees, already you're talking about close to 8 to 10%. So your home has to increase in value more than 8 to 10% just to break even. Previous generations always thought, oh, home values always go up. But we know that's not the case. And you can't assume that you'll be able to sell that home for a profit in the next few years. So looking at it as an investment is a mistake.
Does this all mean that the notion of a starter home is kind of old-fashioned now?
I think the starter home, you know, was a great invention by the realtor associations that sort of came up with this idea of let's really try to push people into home ownership. And, you know, one of my favorites is that they say, oh, it's a great tax break. Well, if you're buying a home that costs under $100,000 as a single person or under $200,000 as a married couple, you may not even qualify. Your standard deduction may exceed the interest tax break you'd get. So unless you have a lot of other deductible expenses, that might not even be a major factor.
A lot of younger people get advice to buy from the older people in their families. Should they be listening to that kind of advice?
I think times have changed. I think it absolutely makes sense to buy a home if you, A, can come up with a down payment for the home, B, you have a steady income to pay for that home. Because that's really the problem that we've seen. People got into homes with no money down. You can't do that anymore. And they were overwhelmed. Suddenly somebody loses a job and you don't have an income anymore. And it's a very tough situation.
What if people do go ahead, they do the math, it just kind of barely works out. They can just squeak into buying that house. If they're really determined to take this plunge, what do they need to know?
I would say just make darn sure that you're going to stay in that home for, you know, at least 4 years. Because if you're not, you may find yourself in a tricky situation that you will not want to have to face.
Beth Kobliner, thanks so much for coming in again.
It's been my pleasure.
Beth Kobliner is a personal finance columnist and the author of the book, Get a Financial Life. We are back with more Getting Personal, and I've got our guest advice guru, Cheryl Harris, here with me. She writes a consumer column for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. You ready for a couple more questions, Cheryl?
Sure thing.
All right. We've got John on the phone calling from Irvine, California. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. And you? How can we help you out today?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I had a question. My lovely fiance had an ugly car accident a few years ago. And as a result, she is being sued by one of the insurance companies for an amount totaling in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we would like to get married sooner than that. And my question is what I could do to protect myself financially.
Cheryl, is this something that could affect him once they get married?
I think, John, the best advice for you is to see a lawyer before you see the minister. The general consensus seems to be that individuals carry their own individual debts with them. But because you live in California, which is a community property state, things can get pretty mucky for you pretty quickly. I'm just curious, is there some reason you haven't contacted a lawyer?
We've actually talked to a couple paralegals and we've gotten different answers from them. So our next step was to talk to a family attorney.
I think you're going to feel a whole lot better if you do, because I think that they can tell you, one, with the real facts of this case, what your exposure really is.
But Cheryl, is this an instance where they would have to put off getting married, or can they go ahead and tie the knot?
You know, John, your fiance is not the bride of Frankenstein, but she's got some scary baggage. I don't think you should do anything before you really know what your risks are and how to proceed. You got this $100,000 suit hanging over your head. If you spend a couple hours with a family law attorney, you spend about $500, and that is a good investment.
Good advice. That's our next step then.
All right. Sounds good, John. And, well, early congratulations on the marriage that will come.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call, and good luck. And next, Cheryl, we have a question that came in via email. It's from Frank in St. Paul, Minnesota. He wants to help a family friend but also protect her privacy. So he wrote in asking about a woman in her 80s whose husband recently died. She has a lot of friends to support her, but she needs some help managing her finances. The husband took care of all the money issues, and she doesn't know how to do it herself. So she also doesn't have any children. There aren't any relatives close by. What kind of resources can you recommend for this woman on behalf of Frank?
I think it's a great question, and the answer's so easy.
It's I like easy answers.
Yeah. Everywhere in the country, there is the Cooperative Extension, and I mentioned them earlier. Yeah. I love them. I what can I say? I think they're a great overlooked resource. They offer classes on a regular basis for people who are just trying to figure out how to manage money. In fact, I looked at the Cooperative in St. Paul, and within a 25-mile radius, there are three basic money management classes that are coming up in the next couple months, and these might be just a great vehicle for her. The other thing is, if she really wants to be private, there are resources online available through the extension that you can pull off. They're worksheets that you do at home, and you just learn basic money management.
And again, those are available across the country.
Those are available across the country. And the easiest way to find, I think, the extension that's close to you is to do an internet search for extension and your state, and it will come up. They're usually attached to universities. You'll always see sort of an EDU website. The other resource that may be useful, and this is also available all across the country, is United Way. They run the 211 service, and usually all you have to do is call from a landline in your home, 211, and it hooks you into the United Way. They can hook you up with a nonprofit. If you want, you can look online. It's 211.org, and you can drill down to find the one that's local to you.
And we'll have links to all of that on our website as well at marketplace.org. Unfortunately, that is all the time we've got for questions on this week's show, but you can ask us about your money anytime. Call and leave a message at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y. Or send us an email, and the way to do that is with the Getting Personal link, and that is at marketplace.org. Cheryl Harris of the Cleveland Plain Dealer, it's been so nice to have you on the show. Thank you so much for the advice.
Thanks a lot. Welcome to Cleveland.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider, helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding, online at finrafoundation.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You can't really come to Cleveland and not think about rock and roll. Cleveland radio DJ Alan Freed first coined the term, and it is said that this city hosted the very first rock and roll concert, the Moondog Coronation Ball in 1952. Of course, now it is home to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and the musicians featured here had their share of fame and fortune and plenty of financial ephemera. So we took a brief tour of some of the cool money-related exhibits with one of the museum's curators, Dr. Lauren Onkey.
This is a fantastic artifact here in the museum. This is Howlin' Wolf's money case. And Howlin' Wolf is a fantastic blues and early rock and roll singer. And he didn't trust banks.
He was ahead of his time then.
That's right. That's right. You know, not only for the history of failure of banks, but if we think about African-American artists and, you know, their relationship to the business and controlling money, there, a whole new set of issues come into play there. So he demanded that he was paid before his performances, and then he kept that money in his suitcase under his chair while he played. This is another fantastic and exciting artifact. It's part of our Bruce Springsteen exhibit, and this is a beautiful 1960 Chevrolet convertible Corvette. Bruce Springsteen bought this car after his first burst of nationwide success with Born to Run in 1975. So we see kind of the ways that an artist would respond to success, you know, finally maybe getting something they've always wanted. Janis Joplin's Porsche is another car that we have that's beautifully painted with all kinds of psychedelic colors and drawings. So that's an example where, you know, she really wanted to kind of show off that she was successful.
Summer time, time, time.
What we're looking at now in our Beatles exhibit is a performance contract from 1960 by the Silver Beatles, which is what the Beatles were called at that time. They're performing with Jerry and the Pacemakers, and they receive a whopping £10 for their performance.
And this is from when?
1960. There you can see the way that even a young band, that they're trying to have to negotiate how long is the performance going to be, where are they going to perform, what will they get paid, and somebody has to kind of do that for them. A manager, or it might just be a friend that works that out for them.
Oh, here we are back in 45 land.
Yeah, right, 45, and we've got some 78s there, too. This is a case celebrating Sun Records out of Memphis, an absolutely essential label to the history of the music. Elvis Presley, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins all came out of Sun Records, and Sam Phillips, that was his label. And one of the great things you see here is his logbook. And then below that, we see the contract for the song Rocket 88 with Jackie Brenston.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88.
And you see that's the contract that recorded that record that some people would argue is the first rock and roll record.
Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Lauren Onke, thank you so much for your time. It's been fun walking around with you.
Likewise, Tess. Thanks for being here.
And for more, you can check out our website. It's marketplace.org. Not all musicians were as paranoid about giving up control of their money as Howlin' Wolf, but maybe they should have been. You know, history is rife with stories of musicians selling thousands of albums only to wind up broke years later. Greg Kot is the host of the music talk show Sound Opinions out of Chi-Town. And Greg, let me ask you first, how typical was it for musicians, maybe especially in the era of Howlin' Wolf, to have a good sense of money management?
I don't think they thought about money management at all. For a lot of these musicians, the whole notion of just having a record out was the prize. That was what it was all about. And all the other issues surrounding that, you know, how do I get paid? What do I get paid? By whom and when? That was all ephemeral. You know, I spent a day with John Lee Hooker about a decade ago, who wrote this amazing song called Boogie Chillin', and it is reputed to have sold about a million copies. And Hooker said, I never saw a dime.
But beyond that, you know, there did come a time when artists did start getting much larger portions of the money that was coming in, and yet they really couldn't manage it themselves. You know, you think even of the late Michael Jackson being in over his head and getting into so much debt, MC Hammer losing his fortune, even Billy Joel. How does this happen?
Well, you know, it's about who you surround yourself with. You know, for example, I've had some experiences being around the Michael Jackson camp over the years. You know, I've never actually spoken to Michael Jackson, but I got to meet some of the people around him. And you just go, this is not going to turn out well for this guy. You just kind of sensed that the people who were supposed to be in charge did not have his best interests at heart.
And yet there are examples, you know, even early inductees to the Hall of Fame that actually were pretty savvy businessmen. People like, you know, Ray Charles come to mind. Any other musicians that were actually good at handling their money?
You know, I've had some experience talking with Mick Jagger, and Mick Jagger doesn't talk too enthusiastically about music anymore, but man, you get him talking about handling the Rolling Stones business affairs and his eyes light up. You know, it's like, whew, we're talking now, you know? The Stones have created the blueprint for the modern rock band in terms of the rock band as corporation, a business that employs hundreds of people. You know, everybody's rolling their eyes saying the Stones are going on the road again next year. Well, that's why. People get paid.
Greg Kot is one of the hosts, along with Jim DeRogatis, of Sound Opinions out of Chicago. Thanks so much for your time.
Tess, my pleasure.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you're unemployed, one cure might be to pick up some work on the side. But keep this in mind.
You don't want to avoid talking about money because it will mean that you don't get paid.
We'll review the rules of freelance. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troe, and Sasha Woodruff. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. And special thanks this week to our friends here at WCPN in Cleveland. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.